From the studios of KUSP Radio in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. At the grocery store the other day, among the latest news about Kim Kardashian and company, I spied a special Life magazine devoted to the Rat Pack, and picturing a cool Dino smiling, a delighted Frank grinning, and Sammy exploding in knee-slapping laughter. It turns out that this Life special on the Rat Pack is a delightful scrapbook of images of our heroes and a rather lengthy, well-written essay by none other than our pal James Kaplan, author of Frank, The Voice, the first volume of the definitive biography of Frank Sinatra. Thankfully, Mr. Kaplan takes time out from his diligent work on Volume 2 to spend a little time talking Rat Pack with us today. James Kaplan, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Oh, I'm always so happy to be here, Gary. Thanks for having me.
So you're before we talk about this wonderful little book, you're really hard at work on Volume 2.
Yes, well, Frank deserves nothing less, and it is a huge life. It's a 60-year career. I broke the biography in half on March 25th, 1954, the point where he wins the Oscar for From Here to Eternity, and he has come back definitively from his unbelievable career downturn, tailspin, death spiral. And now he is rocket-powered into the 1950s, making incredible records with Nelson Riddle at Capitol and making some pretty great movies.
You know, I think if he hadn't had that period of time at Capitol and those great records, I mean, if his career had ended when, you know, when all the other guys faded away, we wouldn't be talking about it now.
You know, I've always been of two minds about that question. That really is that's like the philosophical conundrum of the tree falling in the forest. But Stephen Holden of the New York Times wrote an excellent piece soon after my book came out, and I don't say it's excellent just because he said nice things about my book, but also because he said very good things. And you know, Steve Holden is an exquisitely tasteful and sensitive arbiter of American popular song and its purveyors, and he's a huge fan of the Columbia Records Sinatra of the 40s, as am I. I don't think that he, of course it would have been a very different story, but I think it would have been a large and enigmatic story rather than a forgotten artist.
Well, so do you think this book is a bigger task than you thought it would be when you set out to write it?
Overall or Volume 2?
Both.
Well, certainly. Yes, both. My contract for the book in the first place from Doubleday, my esteemed publisher, said Life of Frank Sinatra, 352 pages. And I got to work, rolled up my sleeves.
I don't even think he was born in the first 352
pages. No, it's nuts. So, no, much far, far bigger than I had ever thought. But as soon as I got reasonably into Volume 1 and saw that it needed to be two volumes, I was aware of the depth and the size of this enterprise.
But this second volume, the years 1955, then I guess, the last 45
half of,
years.
Half of 54 up until May 14th, 1998, when he died.
An eventful period of time.
To put it very, very mildly, yes. He Sinatra from 1954 until his, put it in quotation marks, his retirement in 1971, his very brief retirement. Let's say from 54 until about 68 or so, 67 or 8, his life is just on an insane overdrive. He is making amazing records. He is making some brilliant movies, at least into the early 60s. He's making some brilliant movies here and there, and he is becoming a force of nature as a businessman. He's buying aircraft companies, he is buying missile parts companies, he's buying real estate, he's starting his own record label in 1960, Reprise. It's a mammoth life.
It seems that looking back on the life, he is a better actor than he was perceived to be during his acting career?
I interviewed, I had a wonderful interview the other week with Leonard Slatkin, the conductor of Detroit Symphony Orchestra, whose parents, Felix and Eleanor, were players, violinist and cello, respectively, on many Sinatra sessions. And Frank loved them, and they loved Frank. And Leonard Slatkin said an interesting thing, and I think it's arguable. I don't know if it's definitive, but it's arguable. He feels that Sinatra is far better in his dramatic roles than in his musical roles, and I think there's an argument to be made there.
Well, the argument is the Manchurian Candidate, the Man with the Golden Arm.
Yeah. Yeah, and then a couple of little things. There's a movie he made about a presidential assassin called Suddenly.
Mm-hmm.
It was the first movie he made after From Here to Eternity, and it's a good little movie. It's a solid little movie. And then there's his first Western, Johnny Concho, which has never been put on DVD because
it's terrible.
It is just unbelievable. It is like it's so much worse than the worst episode of Gunsmoke.
Well, but not necessarily more terrible than some of these Rat Pack movies. So let's talk about the Rat Pack. This little book, and I'm going to mention it again. It's called The Rat Pack: The Original Bad Boys by James Kaplan and the editors of Life, and you can find it right next to Kim Kardashian's breast at the grocery store.
Yes. Side by side by side.
The essay that you wrote for this book, is it an excerpt from Volume 2, or it's all...
No, it's a sort of warm-up for Volume 2 uh-huh. in a lot of ways. There's a lot of material that I had to begin to address, and I think people who read Volume 2 may find a lift here or there from this life project. But there's also a lot of material that I still need to digest and to think about. But it's a beginning. It's a beginning. I've had very strong feelings about the Rat Pack from the start. I've always felt a sort of unpopularly thinking feeling when it comes to the Rat Pack,
mm-hmm.
Who are so lauded in the culture at large. And it's always been a phenomenon that maybe because I don't want to sound snotty about it, but maybe because I know too much about the individuals involved and the disasters they wrought on those around them through their lifetimes and especially through this period. And the unfortunate involvement of our young lost president John F. Kennedy around the Rat Pack and around the time of the Rat Pack. It's what I say about the second volume of my Sinatra biography is that it's a different book from the first. It's a darker book, and there's a lot of darkness to it. There is the Rat Pack, which seems to me a dark period. There is Frank Sinatra's involvement with Jack Kennedy, which contains considerable darkness. There is increased involvement with the mafia. There's a lot of bad stuff, and a lot of bad stuff for all the fun that there is with the Rat Pack, and there is some fun. There's an awful lot of bad stuff, too.
Well, I think this picture on the cover is such a telling picture in all three of their personalities. Are revealed, at least to me, you know, the kind of over-laughing Sammy, the Dean looking off in some other direction.
Always.
And Frank sort of tolerating it.
Yeah, I've been writing about the genesis of the Rat Pack in my second volume lately, and I've been thinking an awful lot about Humphrey Bogart. And he's really the reason behind the Rat Pack. There were two Rat Packs. The first Rat Pack was the Holmby Hills Rat Pack, which centered in the Humphrey Bogart, Lauren Bacall household, and was formed one night at Romanoff's restaurant upstairs in the special room that all these people hung out in, Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall and the David Nivens and Sinatra and Swifty Lazar, the agent, a couple of other people. And it was all ironic. It was all ironic the first time around. It came from Humphrey Bogart's feelings of rebelliousness against Hollywood and his cynicism about all things Hollywood. And he was cynical even about the Rat Pack itself, positions were handed out at the first meeting of the Rat Pack, so-called, and Lauren Bacall was a den mother, and Frank Sinatra was chosen as the pack leader, and Humphrey Bogart, whom Sinatra idolized, was designated rat in charge of public relations.
Did Bogart like Sinatra?
He did. It was an unequal relationship. Sinatra... Bogart was a rich boy. He was a rich boy. He was an only child like Sinatra. He's a rich boy from Upper Manhattan. His father was a thoracic surgeon. His mother was a famous illustrator who created that picture of the Gerber's baby. And so they had money. And he grew up a rich boy, went to private schools, and he came by his cynicism and his alcoholism honestly, you might say. But I think the thing to understand about the first Rat Pack and about the second Rat Pack is that they both come from a place of, Bogart's feeling about the world was that it was three drinks behind, you know. Well, you can't hold down a 9-to-5 and support a family and catch up with Bogart. It stemmed from an elitist place, as did the second Rat Pack. But the big difference was that Bogart didn't take it seriously, and Sinatra took his role first as pack leader in the first Rat Pack, and then as King Rat of the second Rat Pack, extremely seriously.
Well, I think he liked being king of something.
He did. He liked to be the king, the don, the boss, the chairman of the board, all of the above.
The second coming of the Rat Pack. One of the things that I think is really interesting about it, and I've only really seen, I think there's just one great performance preserved on film that was like a closed circuit broadcast that somehow survived on Johnny Carson as the host rather than Joey Bishop. And Sinatra seems to some degree annoyed. When he's doing his set, he doesn't want any clowning around.
Sinatra had a very he idolized Dean Martin for several reasons. A big reason was that Dean Martin was incredibly funny. He was a great comedian with an absolutely world-class sense of timing, which Sinatra did not have. Sinatra's jokes on stage always fell flat. And Sinatra knew that his strongest suit was to get out there and be the genius that was Frank Sinatra and sing his songs. Well, the whole Rat Pack began in that January of 1960 when Dean started interrupting him, essentially doing to Frank what Jerry Lewis had done to Dean back at the 500 Club in 1946.
Uh-huh. But Frank let it happen. He liked it.
Well, he loved Dean. He loved Dean. Anything Dean did until almost the very end when, you know, they had that unfortunate late so-called Rat Pack tour or the Legends, right, whatever it was, with Dean Martin and Frank Sinatra, and Dean dropped out because his son had gotten killed in this jet crash. He was in the Air National Guard, Dino Martin, and the bottom fell out of Dean Martin's life. He just, he had no life left anymore, and he couldn't bear the thought of going out and entertaining anybody. And Sinatra was very angry at him about that. But that was 1988, I think. But up until that point, anything Dean Martin did was great with Frank Sinatra, because Dean was funny, he was quick, he was a terrific singer in his own way, and he was big and strong, athletic and handsome, and all of that, and he was Italian American. And Sinatra, who always thought of himself basically as kind of a little punk, a street rat from Hoboken, thought that Dean was great.
We're talking with James Kaplan, the author of Frank the Voice, and now the Rat Pack, the original Bad Boys. The Rat Pack made several films.
Yes.
The films are all, I think, universally terrible. Especially Four for Texas and Sergeants Three, but they're kind of fun, especially Ocean's 11.
Yeah, kind of fun. I find Ocean's 11, I won't say unwatchable, but pretty despicable overall. There are some fun moments in it. Akeem Tamaroff is great. But I find, you know, I'm a guy, and I like things that guys like, and I'm not wouldn't call myself a flaming women's libber or anything like that, although I try hard. But I find the general attitude toward women and behavior toward women, both in Ocean's 11 and around the making of the movie, really reprehensible. And to the extent that it's hard for me to enjoy what's going on when Frank in that movie is lecturing poor Angie Dickinson about, you know, what he expects. It's like Don Draper without the smile, you know.
Right. Well, did that reflect, I'm sure it did. Did it reflect real ideas that Frank had about women?
Frank's feelings about women were extremely complicated and unresolved. He loved strong women. He was also scared of strong women. His mother was an extremely strong woman. Eleanor Slatkin, whom I just mentioned, the terrific cellist who accompanied him on so many sessions and was also a great classical cellist in the Hollywood String Quartet with her husband Felix, was a very strong woman, and always she looked at Frank in the eye, and if she didn't like a take, she told him straight out, in no uncertain language. He always cottoned to women like that, and he always liked strong people in general. If he had a weak movie director, he would make a crappy movie. If he had a powerful movie director, a John Frankenheimer, for example, the Manchurian Candidate director, he would make a terrific movie. So, as far as women were concerned, you know, there were an awful lot of them in Frank's life, and there are an awful lot of different stories about Frank and women, some very bad ones and some kind of interesting ones and some kind of sweet ones, too.
Well, he not only inherited the Rat Pack, but for a while he inherited Lauren Bacall, right?
He did. He did. And that's a funky little story. It's tricky. It's a tricky story to tell. I'm going to try my best to tell it accurately and clearly, it's clear that some sort of romance began between Frank and Lauren Bacall while Humphrey Bogart was dying of throat cancer, and that's a very bad story. Now, whether it was consummated before Bogart died or not, we may never know. But the fact is that Lauren Bacall was a young wife with a much older husband who was dying horribly in those mid-50s days before a lot of enlightenment about cancer. And she was desperate, and Frank was there, and I think that he was very gallant to her in a lot of ways until he turned beastly.
Well, of course, Lauren Bacall wrote about it in her book, but have you talked to Lauren Bacall?
I talked to her. I did a profile of her for New York Magazine a number of years ago, and I think that she has she's decided that she has told her stories in her books and to various reporters, one of whom was me, and she wants to leave it there.
Well, let's talk about some of the other Rat Packians.
Yes.
Well, there was one woman, I guess, and that's Shirley MacLaine. She was kind of a Rat Pack.
Yes.
How did she get into the gang?
Well, she was in Some Came Running as a young actress, and Sinatra and Dean Martin liked her a good deal. I think they both made a run at her sexually, and whether or not she put them off, she claims to have put them off. I'm not sure she put Dean off. I'm not sure she put either of them off, actually. But she was, as she has written in her, two things to know about Shirley MacLaine. She is... I will refine it for the radio. She is eccentric, as we know. She's rather eccentric, and she is also brilliant. She's a brilliant woman. She's a wonderful writer. Her memoir, My Lucky Stars, is really one of the most well-written and incisive memoirs of several important people, Dean Martin, Robert Mitchum, and Frank Sinatra. She has some of the most psychologically acute things to say about Sinatra, and Dean Martin, for that matter, that anybody has to say. And she was madly in love with Dean. She was a very young actress on Some Came Running, which was this movie that Dean and Frank and she made together from a James Jones novel. And that together with the presence on set of Sam Giancana, the Chicago mobster, sort of created the second Rat Pack. That was it in embryo and in early childhood, right on the hoof in northern Illinois in 1958.
Oh, Joey Bishop, I always liked Joey Bishop. I think he was hysterical. He had one great ad lib when he was performing in New York, and Marilyn Monroe walked in late and drew everybody's attention, you know, because Marilyn Monroe walked in.
Yeah.
And Joey Bishop said, "Hey, I thought I told you to wait in the truck."
He was, you know, he made Frank laugh. And from making Frank laugh early on at the Copa in the early 50s, Joey Bishop put together a tremendous career sort of on the aeronautical uplift of Frank's appreciation for his sense of humor. He became their MC, and he did a lot of other things too. He had his own sitcom. He hosted guest hosted the Tonight Show many times. He
had his own late night show opposite the Tonight Show also on ABC.
Yes, that's right.
Regis Philbin was his announcer.
That's right. Yeah.
I like Joey Bishop a lot. Peter Lawford, he was the president's brother-in-law.
He was the president's brother-in-law, and he was, as he put it himself, he said, "I was a pretty good-looking guy who looked good standing next to a piano." That was the summation of his whole movie career. He was, you know, I knew him a little bit in the 1970s. I hung around with him a bit. He was an incredibly charming guy. He was very, very charming. He was very good looking, and he had, I think, more talent than he was given credit for. But he, like Sammy Davis Jr., really fell under the thumb of Sinatra, and was the victim, as Sammy was, of Sinatra's vendettas and bad moods to the point of really sort of being nullified.
We're talking with James Kaplan, and his latest book is a Life magazine book about the Rat Pack. I saw Sinatra perform many times, but I only saw Sammy perform once in Las Vegas.
Yes.
In a very small room. Everyone was smoking, including Sammy. The whole room was filled with this blue smoke.
Wow.
But he was absolutely an amazing...
He was a force of nature. He was... Listen, the guy was a genius, and he was a tragic genius, because he was a tiny man I don't know how to say it except to put a fine point on it. He hated himself. He hated the fact that he was black. He hated how he looked. And he was black at a time, at a very, very rough time in American history. And he idolized Frank Sinatra, and unfortunately made himself into a kind of lackey to Frank Sinatra when people all around him, one of whom being Shecky Green, whom I interviewed at length, the terrific comedian, knew Sammy and knew Frank very, very well, were constantly saying to Sammy Davis, "Listen, you know, you're great. You don't need Sinatra. You can have your own career. You don't have to kowtow to him." But Sammy always felt that he had to, and the time when he went on a Chicago radio show and said that Sinatra treated people badly sometimes, and that he, Sammy Davis Jr., was as good a singer as Sinatra was, it was as though he had started World War III. Sinatra just cut him off cold, and Sammy had to come crawling back.
Did they patch it up?
Yeah, they patched it up, but they didn't patch it up in a way that preserved Sammy Davis's dignity. He was a tragic guy, and he died broke, and he shouldn't have died broke. He made a ton of money, and he should have been as big as Sinatra.
How does a guy die broke who's worked every day of his life like that?
He had some bad habits. He had a lot of bad habits, including spendthriftiness. Frank always, I forget who it was who said Frank spent like a drunken admiral. Sammy spent like a drunken commander or something like that. He spent it as fast as it came in. If he was going to buy a Rolls Royce, he had to buy three and not just one. He spent way too much money and had way too many bad habits.
There's a story that Sammy tells in his book, Yes, I Can, which is a lovely book, although I don't think Sammy actually wrote the book.
Yeah, it's an interesting work of a fact bordering on fiction or the other way around.
But he tells a story about how Frank befriended him, going to bat for him at the Copacabana and saying,
oh, yes.
Yeah, this is a factual story.
Frank went to bat for him many times, including when Sammy was still with the Will Mastin Trio. Frank was playing the Paramount and demanded that the Will Mastin Trio play there instead of the Nicholas Brothers, I think it was, who were a much higher profile black act at that point. Frank always wanted a black act on the bill with him, and he loved Sammy from the first time they met. I think Sammy was 16 or 17 when they first met. Sammy started performing at 3 or 4. And he demanded not only that the Will Mastin Trio be on the bill with him at the Paramount, but that they be paid, I think it was $1,250 a week, which was sky high in those days. Frank demanded it. He was very colorblind in many ways, and Frank was. And then he also, he could be awful. He could be perfectly awful with the Amos and Andy routines on stage in Vegas.
Me and My Shadow.
Yeah, Me and My Shadow, and insensitivity toward Count Basie and even Ella Fitzgerald sometimes. The thing about Sinatra is he was many, many people, and so my job is to give you all of them.
Well, I think one of the big shocks of my life was watching the Academy Awards one year, and they gave the Gene Herschelt Humanitarian Award. They don't give that very often. And they gave it to Frank Sinatra. And I said, really? Frank Sinatra, a great humanitarian?
Well, he was in many ways. That is the schizophrenia of Frank Sinatra. He was constantly, through some sense of obligation and guilt, I think, too, giving millions of dollars, often anonymously, to all kinds of people in need, and including his fellow thespians, people like Bela Lugosi and Lee J. Cobb and dozens of stars who were down on their luck at one point or another, or unhealthy, were the beneficiaries of Frank's largesse. And then dozens, if not hundreds, of just civilians out there. Sinatra would read a newspaper story about somebody whose house burned down, and he would send them $20,000. He would make sure they were taken care of. He was constantly doing this stuff, so he could lay claim. And he gave tons of money to Israel. He could lay claim, legitimate claim, to being a humanitarian. And I think it was exactly the flip side of his ability to be a brute and a thug at times.
So which, James Kaplan, which is the real Frank? That's what we need to know.
Both. That's the thing that I have to make everybody understand when they read Volume 2, that this guy who is doing exquisite recordings with a Hollywood string quartet on Close to You, this amazing album he made in 1957, Nelson Riddle and the Hollywood String Quartet, so beautiful, is the same guy who could do unspeakable things to people and do unspeakable things to people and behave unspeakably toward waiters and busboys and prostitutes. It's the same guy. It's not a different guy. The problem with the biographies that have been done so far is they give you the thug. They give you the thug who he sings now and then, but it's just thug, thug, thug. And
right.
What I'm trying to get my mind around and trying to get this book around is the fact that this guy was so many people, and he was constantly reverberating back and forth between one and the other and the other and the other, and it was exhausting.
And there's, he was one of the great, he was the great artist, the great popular vocalist, and so much of his work, even though much of his work is praised and everything, so much has been completely neglected, like Watertown. What a
yep.
great record that is.
Didn't sell. Didn't sell. It was a noble try, and it was also an attempt on his part to recast himself, to remodel himself, to remake himself. Rock and roll hit him and Frank and his ilk. Not that there are many in his ilk, but hit him and his ilk very, very hard. And it didn't hit Frank in the pocketbook that much, or as badly as it hit people like Mel Torme, who seriously considered quitting singing and becoming an airline pilot. Frank was hit hard spiritually by rock and roll in the mid-60s to the late-60s. Watertown was made in, what was it, 70?
Something like that, yeah.
Something like that, yeah. So, Sinatra was heading, he was in his mid-50s, and he was terrified, I think, on some deep level of his being, that he's heading toward irrelevancy. And he was trying nobly and artistically to recast himself.
Just like I hate it when Beverly Sills sings pop music. I usually hate it when Frank Sinatra sings rock and roll music. I can't stand his recording of Bad, Bad Leroy Brown. I don't even like Jim Croce's recording of Leroy. I don't like him.
It's a bad song, that's why.
Yeah, I don't like him doing, Don't Sleep in the Subway, Darling, or any of that crap. But but on the other hand, on Watertown or Cycles, he shows that he can, he can fit perfectly into some modern pop arrangements.
And let us never forget Sinatra Jobim from 1967.
Oh, what a fantastic record that is!
What a fantastic record that is! And yes, it's glorious. It's subtle. It is quiet. It is brilliant. It is and it is very, very different from the American popular songbook that he so centered himself in.
Well, now I also in your volume two comes this wonderful late period where he recorded Trilogy, which is, up there with some of his great records.
Some of it is.
Yeah, some of it's not so great, but gosh, that version of Street of Dreams on there rivals anything he ever made.
Yes, yes.
So we're looking forward to Volume 2. When will we see it? I'm not supposed to ask that.
Since my publisher may be on the listening, I will say.
No one's listening.
Yes, they're always listening. I'll be turning it in very punctually about a year from now, and it should, God willing, come out sometime in late 2014.
Well, we're waiting for it. James Kaplan, thank you so much for being with us again on From the Bookshelf, and we'll see you when Volume 2 comes out.
Always a delight, Gary. Thank you so much.
Well, that's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you had a good time, and we'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can find us on Facebook, and you can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes. I want to thank my guest, James Kaplan, author of Frank the Voice, and his latest little book you can find on newsstands everywhere called The Rat Pack, The Original Bad Boys, from Life magazine. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.